Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining us. Recently, both of Dr. Stephen Meyer's books, Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell, received the audiobook treatment. Now there's a new way to enjoy Meyer's masterful storytelling as he relates the story of origin of life research and the attempts to explain the origin of complex animal life. In both his books, Meyer patiently and clearly explains why intelligent design is the theory that best explains the evidence. He uses the very same scientific methods of reasoning as Darwin and his contemporaries, but comes to a very different conclusion. Both books are now available in audiobook format, and over the space of a few episodes, we're bringing you an extended sample of the audio recording from each, something you'll only hear right here on ID the Future. We'll start with Meyer's most recent offering, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Here's narrator Derek Shetterly reading the first half of Chapter 1.
Part 1. The Mystery of the Missing Fossils. 1. Darwin's Nemesis. When Charles Darwin finished his famous book, he thought he had explained every clue but one. By anyone's measure, On the Origin of Species was a singular achievement. Like a great Gothic cathedral, the ambitious work integrated many disparate elements into a grand synthesis, explaining phenomena in fields as diverse as comparative anatomy, paleontology, embryology, and biogeography. At the same time, it was impressive for its simplicity. Darwin's Origin explained many classes of biological evidence with just two central organizing ideas. The twin pillars of his theory were the ideas of universal common ancestry and natural selection. The first of these pillars, universal common ancestry, represented Darwin's theory of the history of life. It asserted that all forms of life have ultimately descended from a single common ancestor somewhere in the distant past. In a famous passage at the end of Origin, Darwin argued that all the organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from some one primordial form. Darwin thought that this primordial form gradually developed into new forms of life, which in turn gradually developed into other forms of life, eventually producing, after many millions of generations, all the complex life we see in the present. Biology textbooks today usually depict this idea just as Darwin did, with a great branching tree. The trunk of Darwin's tree of life represents the first primordial organism. The limbs and branches of the tree represent the many new forms of life that developed from it. See Figure 1.1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The vertical axis on which the tree is plotted represents the arrow of time. The horizontal axis represents changes in biological form, or what biologists called morphological distance. Biologists often call Darwin's theory of the history of life universal common descent to indicate that every organism on Earth arose from a single common ancestor by a process of descent with modification. Darwin argued that this idea best explained a variety of biological evidences, the succession of fossil forms, the geographical distribution of various species, such as Galapagos finches, and the anatomical and embryological similarities among otherwise highly distinct organisms. The second pillar of Darwin's theory affirmed the creative power of a process he called natural selection, a process that acted on random variations in the traits or features of organisms and their offspring. Whereas the theory of universal common descent postulated a pattern, the branching tree, to represent the history of life, Darwin's idea of natural selection referred to a process that he said could generate the change implied by his branching tree of life. Darwin formulated the idea of natural selection by analogy to a well-known process, that of artificial selection, or selective breeding. Anyone in the 19th century familiar with the breeding of domestic animals, dogs, horses, sheep, or pigeons, for example, knew that human breeders could alter the features of domestic stock by allowing only animals with certain traits to breed. A sheep herder from the north of Scotland might breed for a woollier sheep to enhance its chances of survival in a cold northern climate, or to harvest more wool. To do so, he would choose only the woolliest males and woolliest ewes to breed. If generation after generation he continued to select and breed only the wooliest sheep among the resulting offspring, he would eventually produce a woolier breed of sheep. In such cases, the key is man's power of accumulative selection, wrote Darwin. Nature gives successive variations. Man adds them up in certain directions useful to him. Darwin noted that pigeons have been coaxed into a dizzying variety of breeds. The carrier, with its elongated eyelids and a wide gape of mouth. The short-faced tumbler, with its beak in outline almost like that of a finch. The common tumbler, with its penchant for flying in close formation and tumbling in the air head over heels. And perhaps the strangest of all, the pouter, with its elongated legs, wings, and body overshadowed by its enormously developed crop, which it glories in inflating for its astonished patrons. Of course, pigeon breeders achieved these startling metamorphoses by carefully sifting and selecting. But, as Darwin pointed out, nature also has a means of sifting. Defective creatures are less likely to survive and reproduce, while those offspring with beneficial variations are more likely to survive, reproduce, and pass on their advantages to future generations. In The Origin, Darwin argued that this process, natural selection acting on random variations, could alter the features of organisms just as intelligent selection by human breeders can. Nature itself could play the role of the breeder. Consider once more our flock of sheep. Imagine that instead of a human selecting the wooliest males and ewes to breed, a series of very cold winters ensures that all but the very wooliest sheep in a population die. Now again, only very woolly sheep will remain to breed. If the cold winters continue over several generations, will the result not be the same as before? Won't the population of sheep eventually become discernibly woolier? This was Darwin's great insight. Nature, in the form of environmental changes or other factors, could have the same effect on a population of organisms as the intentional decisions of an intelligent agent. Nature would favor the preservation of certain features over others, specifically those that conferred a functional or survival advantage upon the organisms possessing them, causing the features of the population to change. And the resulting change will have been produced not by an intelligent breeder choosing a desirable trait or variation, not by artificial selection, but by a wholly natural process. What's more, Darwin concluded that this process of natural selection acting on randomly arising variations had been the chief agent of change in generating the great branching tree of life in all its variety. On the Origin of Species seized the attention of the scientific community like a thunderclap. Darwin's analogy to artificial selection was powerful, his proposed mechanism of natural selection and random variation easily grasped, and his skill in dispensing with potential objections unrivaled. Moreover, the explanatory scope of his argument for universal common descent constituted something of a tour de force. By the close of The Origin, it seemed to many that Darwin had dispensed with every conceivable objection to his theory but one. The Anomaly, Darwin's Doubt. Despite the scope of his synthesis, there was one set of facts that troubled Darwin, something he conceded his theory couldn't adequately explain, at least at present. Darwin was puzzled by a pattern in the fossil record that seemed to document the geologically sudden appearance of animal life in a remote period of geologic history, a period that at first was commonly called Silurian, but later came to be known as the Cambrian. During this geological period, many new and anatomically sophisticated creatures appeared suddenly in the sedimentary layers of the geologic column without any evidence of simpler ancestral forms in the earlier layers below, in an event that paleontologists today call the Cambrian Explosion. Darwin frankly described his concerns about this conundrum in The Origin. The difficulty of understanding the absence of vast piles of fossiliferous strata, which on my theory were no doubt somewhere accumulated before the Silurian, that is, the Cambrian epoch, is very great, he wrote. I allude to the manner in which numbers of species of the same group suddenly appear in the lowest known fossiliferous rocks. The sudden appearance of animals so early in the fossil record did not easily accord with Darwin's new theory of gradual evolutionary change, and there was one scientist who would not let him forget it. The Antagonist. Swiss-born paleontologist Louis Agassiz of Harvard University was one of the best-trained scientists of his age, and he knew the fossil record better than any man alive. Hoping to enlist Agassiz as an ally, Darwin sent him a copy of On the Origin of Species and asked him to consider the argument with an open mind. See Figure 1.2 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. One can almost see the great, aging naturalist receiving the unremarkable package from the postman. Unwrapping the small green volume that had stirred such a tempest on both sides of the Atlantic. Perhaps he retired to his study, the better to concentrate, scrutinizing the book's prepossessing title, recalling what he had already heard about the work. He read the book with deep interest, making notes in the margin as he moved through it. But in the end, his verdict would disappoint its author. Agassiz concluded that the fossil record, particularly the record of the explosion of Cambrian animal life, posed an insuperable difficulty for Darwin's theory. The two-pronged challenge. To see why, consider brachiopods and trilobites, two of the best documented creatures in the Cambrian fossil record by 1859. The brachiopod, see Figure 1.3 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, with its two shells looks like a clam or an oyster, but is very different inside. As shown in the accompanying figure, it possesses a gonad, mantle cavity, anterior body wall, body cavity, gut, and lophophore, the last of which is a feeding organ like a ring of tentacles, usually in the shape of a coil or horseshoe, with a mouth inside the ring of tentacles and an anus outside. The brachiopod exhibits a highly complex overall body plan, with many individually complex and functionally integrated anatomical systems and parts. Its tentacles, for instance, are covered by cilia precisely arranged to generate and direct a current of water toward the mouth. Even more sophisticated was the trilobite, see Figure 1.4 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, with its three longitudinal lobes across its head, a raised middle lobe and a flatter pleural lobe to either side, and a body divided into three parts, head, chest, and tail, the former two consisting of as many as 30 segments. It had a pair of legs for every pleural groove and another three pairs for the head. Most dramatic of all were the compound eyes found on even some of the very early trilobites, eyes that afforded these not-so-primitive animals a 360-degree field of vision. The abrupt appearance of such complex anatomical designs presented a challenge to each of the two main parts of Darwin's theory of evolution. The Cambrian explosion and the action of natural selection. The Cambrian fossil evidence represented a significant challenge to Darwin's claim that natural selection had the capacity to produce novel forms of life. As Darwin described it, the ability of natural selection to produce significant biological change depends upon the presence of three distinct elements. 1. Randomly arising variations. 2. The heritability of those variations. And 3. A competition for survival, resulting in differences in reproductive success among competing organisms. According to Darwin, variations in traits arise randomly. Some variations, such as thicker fleece, might confer advantages in the competition for survival in particular environmental conditions. Those variations that are heritable and that impart functional or survival advantage will be preserved in the next generation. As nature selects these successful variations, the features of a population change. Darwin conceded that the beneficial variations responsible for the permanent change in species are both rare and necessarily modest. Major variations in forms, what later evolutionary biologists would term macromutations, inevitably produce deformity and death. Only minor variations meet the test of viability and heritability. It followed that, over human timescales, the benefits of this evolutionary mechanism would be difficult or impossible to spot. But given enough time, favorable variations would gradually accumulate and give rise to new species and, given more time, even fundamentally new groups of organisms and body designs. If artificial selection could conjure so many strange breeds from a wild strain in a few centuries, Darwin argued, imagine what natural selection could achieve over many millions of years. Even the origin of complex structures such as the mammalian eye, which seemed at first to present a significant challenge to his theory, could be explained if one postulated the existence of an initially simpler structure, such as a light-sensitive spot that could be gradually modified over long periods of time. And that was the rub. Darwin's mechanism of natural selection and random variation necessarily required a lot of time to generate wholly novel organisms, creating a dilemma that Agassiz was keen to expose. In an 1874 Atlantic Monthly essay titled Evolution and the Permanence of Type, Agassiz explained his reasons for doubting the creative power of natural selection. Small-scale variations, he argued, had never produced a specific difference, that is, a difference in species. Meanwhile, large-scale variations, whether achieved gradually or suddenly, inevitably resulted in sterility or death. As he put it, it is a matter of fact that extreme variations finally degenerate or become sterile, like monstrosities, they die out. Darwin himself insisted that the process of evolutionary change he envisioned must occur very gradually for the same reason. Thus, Darwin realized that building, for instance, a trilobite from single-celled organisms by natural selection operating on small, step-by-step variations would require countless transitional forms and failed biological experiments over vast stretches of geologic time. As University of Washington paleontologist Peter Ward would later explain, Darwin had very specific expectations for what paleontologists would find below the lowest known strata of animal fossils, in particular, intervening strata showing fossils of increasing complexity until finally trilobites appeared. As Darwin noted, if my theory be true, it is indisputable that before the lowest Silurian or Cambrian stratum was deposited, long periods elapsed, as long as, or probably far longer than, the whole interval from the Silurian age to the present day, and that during these vast, yet quite unknown periods of time, the world swarmed with living creatures. The mechanism of natural selection necessarily had to work gradually on small incremental variations. And, indeed, the kinds of variations that Darwin actually observed and described in developing his analogy between natural and artificial selection were, in every case, minor. Only by selecting and accumulating minor variations over many generations were breeders able to produce the striking changes in the features of a breed, changes that were, nevertheless, extraordinarily modest compared to the radical differences in form between, say, Precambrian and Cambrian forms of life. At the end of the day, as Agassiz hastened to note, the pigeons Darwin cited in support of the creative power of artificial and, by analogy, natural selection were still pigeons. More significant changes to the form and anatomical structure of organisms would, by the logic of Darwin's mechanism, require untold millions of years, precisely what seemed unavailable in the case of the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion and the tree of life. The abrupt appearance of the Cambrian fauna also posed a separate but related difficulty for Darwin's picture of a continuously branching tree of life. To produce truly novel animal forms, the Darwinian mechanism would, by its own internal logic, require not only millions of years, but untold generations of ancestors. Thus, even the discovery of a handful of plausible intermediates allegedly linking a Precambrian ancestor to a Cambrian descendant wouldn't come close to fully documenting Darwin's picture of the history of life. If Darwin is right, Agassiz argued, then we should find not just one or a few missing links, but innumerable links shading almost imperceptibly from alleged ancestors to presumed descendants. Geologists, however, had found no such myriad of transitional forms leading to the Cambrian fauna. Instead, the stratigraphic column seemed to document the abrupt appearance of the earliest animals. Agassiz thought the evidence of abrupt appearance and the absence of ancestral forms in the Precambrian refuted Darwin's theory. Of these earlier forms, Agassiz asked, where are their fossilized remains? He insisted that Darwin's picture of the history of life contradicted what the animal forms buried in the rocky strata of our Earth tell us of their own introduction and succession upon the surface of the globe. Let us therefore hear them, for, after all, their testimony is that of the eyewitness and the actor in the scene. Murchison, Sedgwick, and the Cambrian fossils of Wales. Darwin, for his part, responded with more than civility. Far from dismissing Agassiz, he conceded that his objection carried considerable force, nor was Agassiz alone in pressing these concerns. Other leading naturalists thought the fossil evidence presented a significant obstacle to Darwin's theory. At the time, perhaps the best place to investigate the lowest known strata of fossils was Wales, and one of its leading experts was Roderick M.V. Murchison, who named the earliest geologic period the Silurian after an ancient Welsh tribe. 5 years before On the Origin of Species, he called attention to the sudden appearance of complex designs like the compound eyes of the first trilobites, creatures already thriving at the apparent dawn of animal life. For him, this discovery ruled out the idea that these creatures had evolved gradually from some primitive and relatively simple form. The earliest signs of living things, announcing as they do a high complexity of organization, entirely exclude the hypothesis of a transmutation from lower to higher grades of being. The other pioneering explorer of Wales's rich fossil record, Adam Sedgwick, also thought that Darwin had leapt beyond the evidence, as he told him in a letter in the fall of 1859, "You have deserted, after a start in that tram road of all solid physical truth, the true method of induction." Sedgwick might have had in mind the same evidence the two men had studied together some 28 years before, when the Cambridge professor had brought Darwin along as his field assistant to explore, in the Upper Swansea Valley in northwestern Wales, the very strata that seemed to testify so powerfully to the sudden appearance of animal life. It was these strata that Sedgwick named, after a Latinized English term for the country of Wales, Cambria, a designation that eventually replaced Silurian as the name for the earliest strata of animal fossils. Sedgwick emphasized that these Cambrian animal fossils appeared to pop out of nowhere into the geological column, but he also stressed what he viewed as a broader reason to doubt Darwin's evolutionary model. The sudden appearance of the Cambrian animals was merely the most outstanding instance of a pattern of discontinuity that extends throughout the geologic column. Where, in the Ordovician strata, for instance, are many of the families of the trilobites and brachiopods present in the Cambrian just below it? These creatures, along with numerous other types, suddenly disappear. But just as suddenly one finds newcomers in the Ordovician strata, like the Eurypterans, sea scorpions, starfish, and tetracorals, see Figure 1.5 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. In a later Paleozoic period called the Devonian, the first amphibians, for example, the Ichthyostoga, arise. Much later, many staples of the Paleozoic era, which encompasses the Cambrian, Ordovician, and four subsequent periods, suddenly go extinct in a period called the Permian. Then, in the Triassic period that follows, completely novel animals, such as turtles and dinosaurs, emerge. Such discontinuity, Sedgwick argued, is not the exception, but the rule. Dating by discontinuity. Already by Sedgwick's time, the various strata of fossils had proved so distinct from one another that geologists had come to use the sharp discontinuities between them as a key means for dating rocks. Originally, the best tool for determining the relative age of various strata was based on the notion of superposition. Put simply, unless there is a reason to believe otherwise, a geologist provisionally assumes that lower rocks were put down before the rocks above them. Now, contrary to a widespread caricature, no respected geologist, then or now, adopts this method uncritically. The most basic training in geology teaches that rock formations can be twisted, upended, even mixed pell-mell by a variety of phenomena. This is why geologists have always looked for other means to estimate the relative age of different strata. In 1815, Englishman William Smith had hit upon just such an alternative means. While studying the distinct fossil strata exposed during canal construction, Smith noted that so dissimilar are the fossil types among different major periods, and so sharp and sudden the break between them, that geologists could use this as one method for determining the relative age of strata. Even when layers of geological strata are twisted and turned, the clear discontinuities between the various strata often allow geologists to discern the order in which they were deposited, particularly when there is a broad enough sampling of rich geological sites from the period under investigation to study and cross-reference. Although not without its pitfalls, this approach has become a standard dating technique, used in conjunction with superposition and other more recent radiometric dating methods. Indeed, it's difficult to overemphasize how central the approach is to modern historical geology. As Harvard paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould explains, it is the phenomenon of fossil succession that dictates the names of the major periods in the geological column. See Figure 1.6 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. We might take the history of modern multicellular life, about 600 million years, and divide this time into even and arbitrary units easily remembered as 1 through 12, or A through L, at 50 million years per unit, Gould writes. But the Earth scorns our simplifications and becomes much more interesting in its derision. The history of life is not a continuum of development, but a record punctuated by brief, sometimes geologically instantaneous, episodes of mass extinction and subsequent diversification. The question that Darwin's early critics posed was this: how could he reconcile his theory of gradual evolution with a fossil record so discontinuous that it had given rise to the names of the major distinct periods of geological time, particularly when the first animal form seemed to spring into existence during the Cambrian as if from nowhere?
We'll stop it there for today. On another episode, we'll share the second half of Chapter 1 of Darwin's Doubt, the audiobook version. We'd like to thank Harper One for permission to share the recording with you. Until next time, I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.